This is tape number 2 of Lowell Smale, taking place on April 11, 1994, at his home at 100 Marble Street in Ishpeming, Michigan. Before we go forward to home life, there are a couple quick little terms I wonder if you could define for me. The first one is contracts. What's a contract?
A contract was two men would go in and they'd make a contract with the company, more or less, to produce so many feet of drift in 8 hours. You had three crews working around the clock so that they had to make so many feet to get paid contract wages. If they didn't make that footage, their contract fell way back. They lost money, you might say.
Now, were the contract men employed by the company? They were regularly employed and then they got this contract wage extra?
They were hired by the company. They were employees of the CCI. And this was just to give the men an incentive to make more money. Because if you made more footage in a month, then you made a good wage. But if you fell behind, then you didn't make so much money.
So in other words, the contracts is the same thing as the footage rate you talked about earlier?
Yes, they'd be about the same.
And then when wood and things were delivered to the men who did this kind of work, how were the men referred to? Were they referred to by a certain type of name? Were they called contracts or were they called something else, do you know?
Well, they were called, the people that bought the timber in were timber hoisters. Mm-hmm. And they just took it to the contracts. They called all the places more or less contracts. They were, instead of saying take it to the drifters, they'd say take it to the contract so-and-so. Then you know where you were going.
How about stopes? Can you define stopes for me or describe it?
Okay, we'll start in the back, in the beginning. A stope. To begin with, you had to put up a raise, then you put a drift in, then you put a short raise up off of the drift, and you put blasted holes on an angle, so that's called the cone. And then after the dirt came out of the cone, then they'd drill long holes up in there again and blast it down, and then they would call that a stope. So it's just like a big ice cream cone up in there.
So then drifts were horizontal and raises were vertical, but were they straight up or were they at an angle?
They were roughly at a 60 degree angle off the drift.
And how high up would a raise go? Or how high was the raise? Maybe 10 feet up from the drift, and then there was a stope, or was it 30 feet?
Well, it varied, but most of the time you didn't get into the ore until you were up roughly 70 feet up in the raise. And then they'd make the cone, and then they'd be in ore, and then they'd drill and blast, and then you'd have a stope up there. Sometimes the stopes would go up 100 feet, 200 feet up then. Make a big void in under the ground there.
Then how did the miners get from the drifts up the raises and into the stopes?
Well, we had a ladder road. You'd go in sometimes to the end of the drift and you'd have a ladder road going up and then they'd make dog drifts over to the stope and that way.
You had described a dog drift for me before as being quite small and only large enough for your body. Were most dog drifts that small or were they bigger than that?
Some of the drifts were bigger than that. They were loose ground and that most of the time, so they had to have timber and that up there, so they were roughly 8 feet wide, most of them, 8 feet high.
Do you remember ever having an awareness of being so far underground or any sense of claustrophobia, or do you know of other men who had claustrophobia?
No, I didn't have nothing like that and didn't know of anybody. There's nothing to be afraid of down there, I could see. Just dark when you turn your light out sometimes.
All right, what I'd like to do now is backtrack and talk about family and the other part of life that wasn't involved with working underground. You've already given me your mom and dad's names, but you didn't tell me what their ethnic background was, and I would also like to know the names and birth dates or birth years of your brothers and sisters.
Oh. Well, my mother was English, and my father was Scotch-Irish. And we lived in Nagani.
And what part of Nagani?
The Patch location. That was the South Nagani, you might say.
Are there any identifying county roads or anything that could help us place where that was?
Well, the county road now that goes on past the old tourist park in Nagani. We're on the east end of it.
And were your parents born in the United States, or were they born overseas? Do you know?
My mother was born in Nagani. My father was born in Canada, way up in some little burg up there.
And were you born at home or in a hospital?
I was born at home. I think there was only one or two out of the 12 of us that were born in a hospital.
So there are 12 brothers and sisters in your family all together?
13 all together, but one died when I was a baby.
Obviously, it's hard to remember the birth dates, but could you give me, in order, your brothers and sisters' names, starting from the oldest to the youngest, and if you know middle names, give me middle names as well?
Well, my oldest brother was John William, I think, Smale.
All right, we were talking about the birth order of the 13 siblings. And when you give me their first and middle names, can you tell me which are living and which are dead?
The oldest is William John. He died a few years ago. Beatrice Naomi, she's still living out in Arizona. Wentworth Glenn, he passed away. Robert Newton passed away. Orville Hill, he passed away. Then there's me, Laurel Keith. Then my sister Lorraine Jean passed away. Joan Ann passed away. Mary Jane, Marjorie June, Charlotte Evelyn, and Carol Fay. And that's the list of the crew.
Of your brothers, did any of them besides you work in the mine?
Yes. My brother John worked in the mine. My brother Hill worked in the mine, and that's it.
And you said it was customary in your family that most of the men and most of the kids were called by their second name and not their first name.
Yes. I was the only one for a while there that was called by my first name.
We should probably make a correction in your father's name. You told me it was William Chapman Smale?
Yes, his name is William Chapman Smale. I don't know why they call him so many names, but...
But didn't you say then, when we were talking, when the tape was turned off, that he has another first name?
Wentworth. And Bill sometime.
All right, what I'd like to do is just kind of, we talked a little bit about growing up and the different jobs you had and working at the bomber plant, but I would like to get to how you met your wife and what kinds of things you did when you were dating and about when that was.
Well, the reason I met my wife was I had to come up with my brother to more or less babysit him while he was going with my wife's sister. So then she had to come along to babysit her sister. So that's the way we got started.
So the two chaperones ended up getting married, right?
Right.
Who chaperoned?
We got married before the people we were chaperoning.
I want to know who chaperoned you.
Well, nobody chaperoned us.
Okay. And that was about when?
That was 51 years ago, roughly.
And then when you were dating each other, courting each other, what kinds of things did you do for dates?
Well, sometimes we went as far as Nagani and we bought a pasty and a bottle of orange pop. Then we'd go to a show once in a while, but very seldom. Because we didn't have no money to throw away.
Do you remember what movies you would see when you went to the show?
Not really. It was a little too long ago.
Too long ago. Okay. So then, you dated each other for about how long before you got married? A year?
2 years, roughly.
2 years. And then, when you got married, can you describe a little bit about what your wedding was like?
It was a very peaceful wedding. We got married in the parsonage in Lansing, and the minister and his wife were there. And if I remember right, the minister had on his bedroom slippers. So we got married in Lansing, and then we drove up north in a snowstorm. Had to stop at the ferry, and we had a motel there, but cold.
Okay, a couple of things I want to ask about. Your wife was born where?
In Ishpeming.
So you're from Nagani, she's from Ishpeming, and you have gotten married in Lansing. Can you tell me how that happened to come about?
Well, I was working in a bomber plant in Ypsilanti, and she was down in Lansing visiting her uncle. She was going to get a job down there. So I think her mother wanted her down there so we wouldn't see too much of each other, but she didn't know I was down in Ypsilanti. A little bit away from Lansing, but we got together once in a while.
And boy, wasn't mother-in-law surprised.
She was awful surprised when we came home and told her we were married.
You mentioned another interesting fact. You were married before the Mackinac Bridge was built. How long did it take to take the ferry, and in what month? Do you remember what your wedding date is?
Well, wedding date is in November.
It's a trick question.
It is. But November 25th, it was. But it was cold. It was awful cold coming home. We had to wait for the ferry overnight because we missed the last one that was running for that day. So we took a motel. And cold, and we froze in there. In fact, my wife slept in her snowsuit.
Now, when you say you slept in a motel, was it like a row of rooms, or was it little cabins, or what was it like?
Almost like a hotel, only was strung out all on one floor, if I remember right.
Right, you worked then at the bomber plant, and after that it was military service, is that right?
Yes, then I went into the military service.
And while you were in the service, where was Dawn?
She came home and stayed here in Ishpeming, and she worked at the Gazan.
Then when you were discharged from the service and came back, you said there was about a year before you were hired at the mine?
Yes, roughly a year. Maybe a little longer, but roughly a year.
And where did you live during that time after you got back and before you started working at the mine?
One street over. We had a little apartment.
Now, you came back and from the service approximately what year?
47, 46.
And you said at that time the mines weren't hiring, and so you did another job that we've already talked about. At what point in your marriage did you start building a house, and how did that happen?
In 1947, we started to build. And then we moved in 48, pretty sure.
And what about the land that you built your house on? How did you acquire it, and at what cost?
The land was given to us by my mother-in-law. She bought the land from her father, and she gave it to us as a present.
Now, at the time that you built your house, was home ownership pretty much within reach of most of the people who worked in the mine?
Yes, I'd say it's roughly within reach.
And you said that you built your house yourself, and was it fairly common for the people that you knew to build their own houses as well?
Well, I don't know if it was common, but I had some practice from watching people build houses and that. And we couldn't afford a carpenter, really. So between me and my dad and my brothers, we got it started, and then I finally got it finished.
Would you have any estimate, as you think back, of what it would have cost you at that time for the building materials for your house?
Oh, I'd say around $3,000 for the building materials.
And then, what would you guess? What level of completion was your house at when you moved in?
Well, we had the walls up and the roof on and the windows in. The walls plastered, come think of it. But we lived on rough flooring for a few years. Then we put in the hardwood flooring.
Now, when it comes to where you have lived during the time that you built your house and now, can you tell me where you've lived all that time?
What was that again?
Where have you lived since the time you built your first house?
I lived here all the time.
That's one of those trick questions, right? Okay. Now, let's talk about cars for a minute. Before you were married, did you own a car? And do you remember what make and model and year it would have been, and what the price of that car would have been? And then after you got married, when you would have bought another car and what that might have been?
Well, before I got married, I had a Model T. I was able to work and get enough money together to buy it. Cost a whole $15.
And what year was that? What year was the make of the car?
Model T Ford. It was about a 1923 or 24. Then the next one was a 27 Chevrolet. Then the next one was a 29 Chevrolet. That's the one I did a lot of my courting in. Then after that, I had a locomobile. They don't make them anymore. They haven't made them for 60 years or more. But that was a good car. Very powerful.
Who made the locomobile?
That was name of the company, Locomobile Company.
Do you remember what the locomobile would have cost when you bought it, and did you buy it new or used?
I bought it used, and I think I paid around $25 for it. And then after I had that, then I had another 29 Chevrolet until I went into service. Then after I got out of service, I bought a 1932 Chevrolet. And then after that, I worked my way up to a 38 Chevrolet.
Do you remember when you bought your first new car and what it was and how much you paid for it?
Well, the first new one was a 1953 Chevrolet Bel Air. As far as the price, I am not sure, but around $2,500, I think.
All right, let's talk about kids. I'd like to establish when your kids were born and how that fit in with when you built your house. Were your kids born, first child born before or after you moved into your house? And first, middle, and last name and birth date, if you know it. Otherwise, the year that the kids were born.
Well, Roxy Dawn was born over in the other house, our other apartment. Then we started to build a house, and then Melody Lois came along after we were in here for a year. So that takes care of the... Well, we adopted a boy after that. About in 57, we adopted Michael.
And how old was Mike when you adopted him?
He was 5 years old. His mother and father and brother and sister were killed in a car train accident.
And Michael was a distant relative of yours, is that right?
Yes, he was my nephew.
Can you tell me, during the time that the kids were growing up and you were finishing your house and life was going along, did you take vacations in which you traveled? Or what did you do with your time off with the kids?
Well, we never had too many vacations because you had to work so many years in the company before you got a week's vacation. And there was always work around the house to do. So we never did do much traveling until later on in life, around 56, 57. Bought a piece of property out in the woods and built a camp out there. So that's about as far as we did traveling with the children.
Was that pretty typical of most mining families that people didn't do much traveling?
Yes, most families stayed around home.
We'll get into the subject of camp a little bit more later. Do you remember while the kids were growing up, what kinds of activities you might do on a weekend with the kids, or favorite games that you might have had with them, or favorite activities?
Well, we didn't have too many games that I remember. They generally played with their cousins in the neighborhood here. So,
now that the kids are grown, can you tell me where each of them lives and what each of them does, and if they graduated from college, which college?
Ooh. Well, let's start with Roxy Dawn. She's in Egypt, Switzerland, and she plays with mummies, you might say. But she goes out and she digs up the mummies, and she can tell what they died of, and she works in her lab with them and tells it if it's a man or a woman, what they died of, and roughly how old they were when they died.
So Roxy's an anthropologist?
Yes.
Do you remember which college Roxy graduated from?
Out in California. Oakland?
San Francisco, University of San Francisco.
University of San Francisco.
All right. And how about Melody?
Melody Lois is a nurse anesthetist. She went to Houghton.
Hancock
College of Nursing. Then she got her anesthetist degree in Detroit. No?
Minneapolis.
And how about Michael?
Michael, he's just graduated from high school. That's about, and he lives in Los Angeles. And he's a self-employed carpenter.
And how about grandchildren?
Well, we have two. Melody has two sons. One's 12 and one's 17.
What about religious life? Was your family very involved in church?
We're pretty involved in church. Go almost every Sunday. And then I pass a lot of time down there doing odd jobs, keeping the place up to shape. Because there's always something to do at a church. Always mice getting in and grouping everything up, you might say.
What about the neighborhood? You've lived in the same neighborhood most of your married life. Can you kind of describe how many blocks big it is and kind of the composition of the neighborhood, how long people have lived here and whether there's a big turnover in people?
Well, let's see, the neighborhood is roughly 5 blocks by 2 blocks. And it's fairly well mixed now. We got mostly, well, not mostly. You got a lot of different nationalities living out here now. Years ago, you only had, say, the English, or the first maybe the Finns, and then the English. So it's pretty well mixed up now, though.
And the name of your neighborhood is what?
West Ishpeming.
And where is it in proximity to Ishpeming?
1 mile west of Ishpeming.
This is side two of our conversation with Lois Mayo on April 11, 1994. And at the end of the first side, we were talking about the neighborhood a little bit. And we want to clarify the definition of West Ishpeming, because this is a really important topic to those of us who grew up here.
Well, when you say West Ishpeming, this is the original plat of West Ishpeming.
As opposed to now, there is a...
Now it's way out. It's a couple miles up the highway, even, west this point.
During the time that the kids were growing up and the time that you were working underground, was there ever a time when there was a layoff?
Yes, there was a layoff. Well, sometimes we had the honeydew week. That was a layoff, more or less, where you'd work 3 weeks and have 1 week off without pay.
And how many weeks in a row would you have honeydew weeks?
Just the 1 week. And then you'd work 3 weeks and then you'd have another week off.
But would this be over the stretch of several months, or was it a particular season of the year when they would have the honeydew set up?
We had it roughly a year. Then the mine started going strong again, and then we got working full time again.
How difficult was it during those times to make ends meet?
Well, you saved a little bit on the 3 weeks that you worked, so you have enough to carry you through the layoff week, the honeydew week.
Do you remember any particular things that you would do at home as a family to economize and make money stretch?
Well, you wouldn't buy too much, that's for sure. You try to stretch everything. Maybe you could pick up an odd job somewhere. Or, of course, your wife generally had enough for you to do for the honeydew week. That's why they call it the honeydew week. It's honeydew this, honeydew that. Kept you pretty busy.
And I'll bet you honey got a lot done those weeks, too. Were there any times that you remember that there might have been a very lengthy layoff lasting several weeks at a time?
Yes, in 58, I believe it was, we had a long layoff. Some people had to go and get county help because we were off that long. It was hard finding anything to do that time.
Now, you had a really specific solution to that problem, didn't you, in terms of what you did with your house during that time?
Pardon?
So you had a really specific solution of getting through during a layoff did you rent your house out at one point?
Oh, yes, we rented our house out to an engineer, or super, rather, at the Republic Mining on Construction up there. He was super up there on construction. So we met him in church, and we told him we'd rent him our house. They told us they were looking for a house. So we told him we'd rent our house to him if they'd give me a job. So we rented the house to them, and we went and stayed out the camp, which wasn't complete then. But we had a lot of fun out there. The bears were going around at night, and they never disturbed us for that, but it was one way of getting a job to see us through.
And was this for one summer, or what season of the year, and for how long was it?
It was for a whole year. Roughly 9 months, come to think of it, that we rented a house to him. And then we came back here when the kids went to school. In the fall.
Let's talk a little bit about holidays. What specific things do you remember about Christmas as an example, and the kinds of things that the kids would get for Christmas, and the kinds of things that they wanted, or the things that the special traditions that you had?
Well, Christmas was generally a hectic time. Most of the time we had to work it because you didn't have enough years in to get Christmas off. But then when I did get Christmas off, then we'd do a lot of baking around the house. The kids would get their dolls, the girls would get their dolls, and other girl stuff. And Michael would get toys, but they didn't seem to last too long. Kind of rough on his toys.
What specific kinds of things did you bake around Christmas time?
Well, we baked a lot of saffron, gumdrop cake, white bread.
Now, most people would be familiar with saffron as a spice. Can you be a little more specific about what you did with the saffron?
Well, we put raisins in, or all depends. If you were rich enough, you could put currants in, because currants were high price. So we generally used raisins.
And was saffron a cookie or a cake or a bread or what?
Well, we made two things. We made cake and we also made a saffron bread.
One of the things that we haven't really talked about at great length, and it's something that we touched on a little bit when you talked about building your house, and that is the extent to which you and a lot of other people were do-it-yourselfers. What kinds of things did you learn to do yourself that really multiplied what you were able to do with your money?
Well, I did all the carpenter work on the house, or most of it. I did all the plumbing. And I did most of the, well, I take that back. I had the electricians install the first electrical wiring in the house. But over the years, I upgraded it because of the new dryers and stuff. You got to upgrade your electrical system every so often.
What about working on cars and maintaining cars?
Well, I learned to repair cars when I was very young because those days nobody knew or could afford to take a car to the garage to have it fixed. The neighbors would have a car and they'd break down and we'd go over and watch them repair it. So after you watch a person not long enough doing this and doing that, you get pretty good at it. You can do it yourself. Find out what's wrong and correct it.
The desire and necessity to do it yourself, was that a pretty strong trait among the people that you knew and that you worked with and that you in the neighborhood?
Yes, most of the time you had to do it yourself because you couldn't afford to take it to the garage. But the people got a not a thrill. Satisfaction out of doing your own work.
Is it would it be accurate to say that most people that you worked with and lived with were pretty proud people who took a lot of pride in doing things themselves and in not accepting help from other people?
Yes, people took a lot of pride in what they could do. If you could do something and somebody else couldn't, you generally went and helped them. So, if you went and helped somebody who knew how to plaster and that, they'd probably do something for you in their line of work. So,
how about saving money? How easy was it for people, or how much discipline did it require to save money, or was that even possible when your kids were growing up?
Well, it wasn't possible to save money when the kids were growing up because they always needed a new pair of shoes or a pair of glasses. But after the kids' children were gone and Don had went to work, then we start saving pretty heavy. So now we're, you might say, on easy street according to some people, but we try to still save. We still don't splurge, because save it for a rainy day. That's what way I was brought up for, so I still kind of keep that in the back of my mind.
You mentioned Don starting to work at a certain point. About how old were the kids when she started to work, and what did she do?
The kids were gone from home when Don went back to college and came an LPN. Then she worked for a few years as an LPN. She liked it so much she went and got her RN. Then she worked a few years at that. So she had a good career at nursing. She's still a pretty good nurse.
All right. Now, let's talk a little bit about camp. For those of us who live in the UP, we all know what camp is, but can you define that for us a little more clearly?
Well, Our camps are like a second home. They're built, so we got quite a few conveniences at them. Microwaves, refrigerators, indoor plumbing. So they're pretty well up to date. Soft beds, some people got hard beds. A hard bed is the best one to sleep in, it don't hurt your back.
Now, do most people have camps on a river or a lake?
Most people have them on a lake. Few people have them on rivers. Some people have a dry camp, too. That's where there's no water around at all. And they seem to like it better than people on the lake. They have more privacy. That's what they like it.
Now, at what point, or can you tell me what year you acquired the property for your camp, and then what year you started building, and would you be willing to say what the cost of your lakefront property was at that time?
I'm pretty sure we bought it in 57. And at the time we bought it, was $500 for a 100-foot lot, and it goes 1,300 feet back. But now, you never touch it for that. It'd probably be $3,500 for the same lot nowadays, if you can get one.
And that's probably conservative at that point. That's real conservative.
Yes, that's real conservative.
Can you tell me a little bit about, compared to those early years when the kids were growing up and times were really tough and money was tight, what kinds of things have you been able to do since you retired or since the kids have grown and gone in terms of travel or favorite toys that you've wanted to have and things like that that you finally have treated yourself to?
Well, I haven't bought many toys since the children left, but I did buy a new truck in 84. I still got it. It got 35,000 miles on. Bought a paddle boat for out to camp. But bought a trailer. We're going to travel, but we changed our mind, so we get rid of that one these days.
What about hobbies? Did you have time for hobbies when the kids were growing up? If so, what were they? And do you have any hobbies now, and what are they?
Well, when the children were growing up, the only hobby I really had was hunting. And then after the children left, I started rock collecting. And I got a pretty good rock collection that, well, it ain't too valuable, but I think it is. I'm into micro-mounting now. That's where you can put a lot of your rocks in one egg carton, and you don't take up half the house with your big chunk. It's a lot of fun.
Do some of the specimens that you collect, are they closely connected with mining or just with the general geology of the area?
Quite a few of them are from the mines around here. Some I bought home from the mine myself, and the majority of them are iron-related.
Now, that brings to mind another question that I had wanted to ask earlier. In terms of bringing things home from the mine, did the mine have kind of like a policy on surplus materials and things that they would let the miners purchase or take home from time to time, and if so, what might those be and how would they be used?
Well, underground they didn't want you to bring anything out because that would be put, everybody would be bringing something up and there would be too much weight on the cage, you might say. They sort of frowned on that. But the open pit, you can get permission. Not every day, but once in a while they give permission to take some specimens off. Very small ones, so not large specimens.
Now, I guess I'd like to get a little further into the difference between the time when the kids were growing up and how life is now. And you've recently had a chance to do some traveling. Can you tell me about that a little bit?
Well, we went around Lake Superior three times now since the children have gone.
And you've been overseas. You've been overseas and had some pretty interesting experiences over there.
Yes. This past year, we went to visit our daughter. We met her in Amsterdam. We flew from Amsterdam down to Cairo, and from Cairo back to Switzerland, then from Switzerland to London, then from London home. It was a very enjoyable trip. I'm going again one of these days.
What kinds of things did you get to do on this trip that not everyone gets to do when they travel?
Well, we got to go in the back door of a lot of museums. We've seen stuff in Cairo that the public won't see for 10-15 years. Seen some of the old mummies that they're working on that won't be displayed for a long time. They have to keep the mummies in a mixture of nitrogen and at a certain humidity. They're working on them. It's interesting to see them when they're before the public sees them. That shows them how they opened up some of them, and I enjoyed it myself.
One last question I have to get on tape for posterity is, you had a rather unusual mode of transportation at one point when you were in Egypt. What was that?
Oh, we were on a camel for a while. That was old stuff to me, because when I was in India during the war, I was on a camel, but it brought back memories, so.
Over the course of the years that you worked in the mine, did you see any significant change in people's attitudes toward work? And do you feel that the times have changed significantly from the time that you were raising your family until the present time when people are raising their families and working?
Well, the people nowadays, young fellows, they do not take pride in their work. They just go to work to put in their 8 hours. They don't want to put up their production. They don't care if they get the job done or not. As long as they're there for the 8 hours, that's it.
Now, was this an attitude that you saw in younger men before you retired?
Yes, this is the way it was before I retired there. They came in and they just didn't take pride in their work. They just wanted to be there and that's it. Sometimes they didn't even want to be there. They wanted to be paid for staying home.
One last question that we should have touched on earlier and did not is in the early days when you first started working underground, was there a noticeable ethnic mix of people, and were there other languages spoken underground? If so, what were they?
Well, there was different nationalities working when I worked in underground, but very few spoke any different than English. Maybe if you had four or five Finnish fellows together, they'd speak Finn, but if there was somebody English there or that, or Italian, I couldn't understand them, then they'd go back to English. We never had any problems that way in underground. Everybody was one happy family, you might say.
In terms of neighborhoods and things like that when you were growing up. Did people of different nationalities tend to live together in their own neighborhoods in the various parts of Ishpeming and Nagani that you're familiar with?
Well, I'm familiar with Nagani, so we had Italians in one section. In the lower patch location, there was mostly Italians down there. Then we had Frenchmen down in one section. Then Cornish Town, they were mostly Cornish up there.
Can you roughly identify, you know, if people had a present-day map of Nagani, approximately where each of these things would be?
Well, if you had a map, you could find out where they were. Cornish Town is west of Nagani. Patch location is southeast. And that's about it.
When in the years when you were dating, before you were married, and even around the time you were married, was there a general feeling that that people could or could not marry someone of a different ethnic origin or different religion? How much intermixing was there at that time, say in the 30s and 40s?
Well, I'd say back in the 20s, it was stricter. You couldn't marry out of your own nationality. The Catholics especially were strong on it. The Italians down by us, they were very strict on it. There used to be knife fights even down there. I know of two knife fights that I've seen myself. Two guys wanted to date the same girl and they couldn't because they weren't Catholic. And so they had a little fight. Neighbors had to break it up before anybody got seriously hurt. But the French, from what I seen when I was growing up, they were the strictest Catholics. You had to be marry a Catholic and that was it. You didn't go anywhere else. The Frenchmen, they seemed to marry intermarriage, you might say, when they could, from what I experienced in the Nagani.